This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Sreets. Picture a trip to your backyard. Pick lemon balm for your tea, fresh borage for your soup, nasturtium, and good King Henry for your salad, and Jerusalem artichokes to fry up like potatoes. Well, you can do all of this and a lot more if you have what's called a forest garden. Dave Jackie, author of Edible Forest Gardens, is pushing this ancient idea of an edible ecosystem as both a practical and environmentally healthy way to use land that is now mostly turf grass, that is your backyard. This hour we'll hear more about forest gardening. Also, 15 years after 4,000 or so Bosnians relocated to Waterloo as a result of their brutal civil war, the Cedar Valley will celebrate their resettlement in events later this month called Fields of Opportunity. We'll hear from two of the organizers, Ryan Haynes and Zolfida Rieschuk, following news from NPR and IPR. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Rees. Forest gardening isn't a new invention, but the concept may be unknown to a lot of people. It's a food production and land management system using bushes, shrubs, herbs, and vegetables which have yields directly useful to humans. Forest gardening has been getting a big boost from Dave Jackie, author of Edible Forest Gardens, and local organizations are forming to push the idea, such as Fred Meyer's Backyard Abundance in Iowa City. Jackie says perennial vegetables such as skirret, sorrel, good King Henry, borage, and pokeweed are good eating, and they'll grow in your backyard. I asked Jackie to explain the concept of forest gardening.
Forest gardening is a way of designing gardens that mimic the structure and function of forest ecosystems but grow food. Not just food, actually. I call them the seven Fs: food, fuel, fiber, fodder, fertilizer, pharmaceuticals, and fun. So we're trying to use the forest ecosystem as a model for design, as a metaphor. Doesn't mean you have to have woods in order to do it. You can start with, in fact, I like people to start with lawn and convert that to a forest garden, which can take many different forms, from something that's very woodsy or something that's very open with scattered trees and shrubs and a lot of herbaceous stuff. But it's basically you're using all different layers of vegetation, using trees, you're using shrubs, you're using vines. You've got a whole range of different plants in the ground layer, wild edibles, perennial vegetables, medicinal plants, just ground covers to help keep weeds out, things like that. So all the plants ideally are performing multiple functions, either providing food or medicine, they may also at the same time be attracting beneficial insects, providing habitat for spiders, or, like I said, keeping out weeds with ground covers, improving the soil, fixing nitrogen out of the atmosphere, or pulling up nutrients out of the subsoil to improve the soil, and on. There's many different things that plants can do for us in our gardens.
Did you invent this yourself, or has this concept been around for a while?
Well, no, far from inventing it myself. No, I am one of a long history of people who've been involved in forest gardening, not necessarily by that name over the years, but in fact, the Native Americans eastern part of North America used to do something very similar to this, although we don't have a lot of information for eastern North America because most of the Native people were wiped out and we didn't learn what they were doing. But there's been a lot of work. People have been doing forest gardening in the tropics for thousands of years, very large areas. In fact, there's a lot of evidence now that large areas of the Amazon rainforest were actually human-managed, human-created ecosystems with a lot of edible species in them. But all over the world, not as much known about temperate climate forest gardening like the areas that we live in here in Iowa and where I live in Massachusetts, but there's a lot of people working on it, and it's very popular in Britain and Europe right now. And my co-author Eric Tonesmeyer and I wrote a book called Edible Forest Gardening it took 8 years to write, but we finished it in 2005, and because no one was really doing it or playing with it much or had done much research on it in North America, so we wanted to bring it to North America.
Okay, Dave, paint us a picture. Let's say somebody has a suburban house and an acre, which is a pretty good-sized lot.
Yeah.
And right now they're just they have Kentucky bluegrass. How do you gradually, I assume you would do this gradually, change this into a forest garden? Can you give us a step-by-step approach?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of different ways you can go about doing it. You can do it all at once. You can do it very slowly if you so desire. Basically, the first step is to get to know your land and what your goals are and design the space and figure out what, do you want to grow fruits? Do you want to grow nuts? What kind of things do you like to eat? Do you want to grow medicinals? Do you want to grow dye plants? If you had a hobby of knitting and you wanted to grow dye plants to dye wool, you know, you could do that. You could design a garden for many different purposes. But so the design comes first, at least in my opinion. You can also go about and just plant stuff, but you're more likely to make mistakes that way. So I usually design with people first, and then basically what I do is I plant the woodies, the trees and shrubs first, and then we do this thing called sheet mulching, where you basically cover the ground very thickly with different kinds of mulch in different layers. If you have a seedy mulch with like hay, horse manure, which tends to have a lot of weed seeds in it, you put that down first, and then you can put cardboard or newspaper or some other sheet material on top that'll biodegrade, and that helps kill all the weeds and all the grass that's underneath there. And then you put compost or any seed-free mulch on top of that, and then you plant your perennial herbs right through that mulch into the ground.
Okay.
And basically what you're doing is you establish a weed-free system from the get-go, and then everything you plant just kind of takes off and takes over.
Well, that certainly makes sense to get rid of the weeds. How does the concept of a forest garden differ from just somebody deciding to plant a really big old traditional Iowa garden?
Well, first of all, we're mainly planting perennials in forest gardens. We're using plants that live more than 1 year. Most of the crops that people grow throughout most of the world are annuals. They die the first year and go to seed. So we're planting perennials. Asparagus is a well-known edible perennial that people know, rhubarb. There's many, many other perennial vegetables you can grow. There's a whole book that my co-author wrote called Perennial Vegetables. It's all about that. But also tree crops, fruits, apples, plums, pears, peaches, those are all perennials. You've got blueberries, hazelnuts, filberts, things like that. There's many different kinds of trees that you can grow and shrubs. You know, we're growing perennials because they take less work. You put them in the ground once, and you can harvest for years. There's a plant called French sorrel, which some people may know, which makes a really tasty edible, sour-tasting green. It's great in soups. You plant it once, and it comes up every April, dies back in the fall. And in between, you're harvesting greens throughout the whole year, especially if you have this one variety called Profusion, which never goes to seed. So you're getting greens from April through October. You plant it once, and you've got it for years, maybe even decades, just from planting a plant once. And all you got to do is mulch it and throw some compost on it once in a while.
This sounds almost too good to be true, but, you know, not every vegetable is a perennial, right?
I mean, oh, correct, yeah.
I'm thinking, what if you want tomatoes?
Well, tomatoes actually are a perennial, but they're tropical, so they die in the wintertime. So if you had a greenhouse, you could grow tomatoes year-round all year. They wouldn't necessarily fruit all the time, but most of the crops that we grow are either annual or we treat them as annuals because they die back in the wintertime. So a lot of the crops that we're talking about are things that people are less familiar with. For instance, another example besides the French sorrel, chicory. It's a gourmet green. It's a slightly bitter green, very high-value crop in some restaurant or other markets, and you can grow them. They grow in partial shade. The French sorrel also grows in partial shade, so you can put it under a tree and it'll do fine. There's violets. There's 450 species of violets on the planet, over 450 species. There's thousands of cultivars. All violets are edible to one degree or another.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they're edible, the stems, the leaves, the flowers, everything. Now, you know, I should warn people that some people do have odd allergies that you don't know about, so if you're going to try a new crop, you got to be a little careful and taste a little bit and see how your body does. So that's a little disclaimer there. But I've never known anyone to have an allergy to violets. But not all violets taste good. The yellow-flowered violets tend to be a little bitter, and there's some violets that have hairy leaves that are not as—they don't have what in the food industry they call it mouthfeel. They don't feel very good in your mouth. So.
Yeah.
So, but there's a cultivar called Rebecca that I discovered that tastes like a mix of vanilla and wintergreen. It's delicious.
Mm-hmm. And so, all of these things can be grown here in Iowa.
Well, not all, but many. Yes,
yeah.
I mean, you know, with climate change or climate chaos, as I like to call it, because it's more accurate. You know, Iowa has warmed up. There's a new hardness zone map that indicates that Iowa is mostly zone 5 now, plant hardness zone 5. It used to be zone 4 and zone 5, so we've had significant warming already. So you've got more crops you can grow here now,
yeah.
Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. You know, some of the perennial vegetables are more tropical or subtropical, but there's plenty, you know, Good King Henry is another one. There's Skirret. There's a whole bunch. Jerusalem artichoke or sunchoke, some people call it, is a native one that's hard to zone to. It's an incredible root crop. I put 50 small tubers in the ground in my garden a couple years ago, a 10 by 20 plot. I got 150 pounds of tubers out of that thing, and they're really delicious.
And what do you do with them?
You use them just like potatoes.
Okay.
The other thing about Jerusalem artichoke that's great or sunchoke that's great is that they are a great for people who have diabetes because they're high in inulin, or I forget exactly how that works, but they don't cause a diabetic reaction. So if you can't eat potatoes because of diabetes, you can eat sunchokes and you'll be fine.
You're talking about a whole new way of doing things. This is the most radical concept in gardening that I've ever heard of, because you're mentioning just tons of things that I would imagine that the average Iowan has never heard of. But you can they're all food.
Yeah.
Mostly all food.
Yeah. All the things I've mentioned anyway, yeah.
Are food so far. But you talk about the seven Fs. Again, food, fuel, fiber, fodder, fertilizer, pharmaceuticals, and fun. Now, you work out of Greenfield, Massachusetts. Your business called Dynamic Ecological Design. Dave, this is probably a similar climate, isn't it, to what we have here in Iowa?
Oh, yeah. Yep. I used to live in New Hampshire. Plant hardness zone 4, and now I live in Greenfield, Mass, which is zone 5 according to the old USDA maps, but it's now zone 6 because of the climate chaos. So I have a similar climate, but very different soils. You have very nice soils out here. I was jealous when I was taking the train out here. I was going, wow, look at that. But we have rocky, shallow soils out there, pretty acid soils. But a lot of the stuff that I can grow, you can grow.
But, when I go back to thinking about that traditional Iowa garden, I mentioned tomatoes.
Yeah.
We've talked about that.
Yeah.
And there's a way to deal with tomatoes, a greenhouse, although that may not be easy for everyone
to have
a greenhouse. But what about, the other things you might grow in a garden? Lettuce, carrots, green peppers.
Yeah.
Do all of these fit in with forest gardening?
Sure. I mean, I'm not saying you can't grow those or you shouldn't. I love carrots and I love lettuce and green and, sugar snap peas. I mean, I love all that stuff. It's just that I'm looking to expand the range of foods I can grow. I mean, in the world, there's 10 or 20 crops that make up the vast majority of what people eat in the world. And we're over-relying on those. It's a narrower nutritional profile than we probably need as a healthy diet. And it's a lot more work. A lot of us have busy lives. Perennials take less labor.
Okay. I can certainly find the beauty in that.
Yeah.
That part. We need to take a short break. You're listening to Talk of Iowa. And I'm discussing forest gardening with Dave Jackie from Greenfield, Massachusetts. He's the author of a very popular two-volume book called Edible Forest Gardens. He's here in Iowa for a workshop. We'll also be speaking with Fred Meyer of Backyard Abundance in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese. We're speaking about a concept, the radical concept in gardening. It seems to me, anyway, it's fascinating, but very, very different for Iowa, a concept called forest gardening. Dave Jackie, who runs Dynamic Ecological Design in Greenfield, Massachusetts, is here in Iowa for a workshop on forest gardening. Fred Meyer is director of Backyard Abundance, which is a nonprofit organization. Fred, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dennis.
Obviously, you believe in this concept of forest gardening. Dave describing the many advantages, the many plants that we've never heard of that can be used for all sorts of things. How is this concept working out for you? Are you seeing much forest gardening here in Iowa?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's something that's going to become increasingly popular if our organization has anything to say about it. And Backyard Abundance's mission is to help people learn how to create beautiful, resilient landscapes and communities by mimicking structures found in nature. And so Dave Jackie literally wrote a book on that subject, and so naturally that's why we brought him here to help us learn more about that concept. And as people are looking at their turf grass-covered backyards, they're all wondering the same thing. What do I do with this space? they mow it, and then they mow it some more, and then they mow it some more. And a lot of people don't mind mowing so much, but there's a lot of people out there who want to do something different with the space. And that's where Backyard Abundance can help. We help show people how to partition up that space based upon their goals, which is what Dave was talking about, and learn how to create the space so it works better for them in their lives, better for their neighborhood, better for our community.
Are there examples of forest gardening that you can point to in Iowa? I mean, how often, if you drive down a street or a county road, how often do you find forest gardens?
One of the things Backyard Abundance has been doing since its inception is finding folks in the community who have consciously designed their yards to benefit themselves and the environment as well. And we these folks open up their yard to the public for a couple hours, okay, and folks funnel through their yard, and they get ideas and take those ideas home with them and implement them in their own yards. And so this idea of edible forest gardens can be implemented in a number of different ways. And a lot of these folks who are in our community have already done different types of implementations.
Okay.
Like
do you have your own forest garden then?
I am in the process of converting my backyard into a forest garden. What's interesting about my backyard is it's just a big place to experiment. I started out with a lot of annuals. Yeah. And to be honest, I got a little, you know, I love growing stuff, but I got a little tired of always going out there and watering the annuals and, you know, keeping them up. And, you know, I learned a lot of techniques to make it lower maintenance, but perennials are the ultimate in low maintenance. And so I'm now in the process of converting more of my yard over into perennials, putting in more perennials in it.
So okay, well, give us a snapshot of your backyard and the way it's looking now. And and Dave Jackie was describing some of these interesting plants that one can grow, have great advantages, but maybe a lot of people haven't heard of. What do you have so far going?
Well, my backyard, when I first moved into my house in 2001, was all turf grass, just like most other people's yards, with some burning bushes and some maples along the edge. And so over the years, I started changing small parts of it into annual garden beds, doing the sheet mulching technique that Dave mentioned.
And yeah, no weeds, right? That gets rid of the weeds.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. So now it's all, the entire backyard is a vegetable and herb garden. Right when I walk right outside the door, there's a little patch of, I call it my greens garden, and it has in it French sorrel, like Dave was mentioning, and there's some good King Henry there, and I plant annual lettuce in there too, and basil, and some other things, that chives that I frequently harvest. And so because it's right outside my door, these are things that I frequently harvest, it makes it easier to harvest from the space, and that lowers the maintenance burden and lowers the amount of time that I have to spend in my garden finding things. And then if I wander back in the further parts of the garden, this is where there are more perennials. Like I've got some sunchokes back there as well. Dave mentioned those. But I love heirloom tomatoes, and yeah, so I've got a lot of those in my garden as well.
But those are annuals, right?
Correct. In this climate, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. In this climate. Does this also make it a lot easier to start in the spring each year and getting the garden going? It sounds like it just sort of, once you have this forest garden in place, it just kind of, it just keeps going year round. I mean, the snow melts, and how much actual work do you have to do to get it to get going in the spring?
It's a lot less maintenance than perennial gardens. Typically, the only thing you have to do from year to year is sometimes throw on some additional mulch if your ground cover isn't taking over as well as it should. Usually the system, once you get it up and going, it usually takes 2 to 3 years to get the system up and running. But once it gets up and running, if it's designed correctly, a lot of the plants start taking care of themselves. And that's the miracle that edible forest gardening brings to us, is we can create spaces that are more self-maintaining. Mm-hmm. So we end up just being kind of managers of the space, kind of trying to guide it in the direction that we want it to go, rather than constantly overseeing it and constantly watering and weeding.
Well, you've sold me on this completely and totally. So it cuts down on watering, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful.
One of the things that Dave's book promotes is, instead of constantly mulching and constantly weeding and Instead, put down, find some ground covers and put down a mix of ground covers. A lot of these ground covers are edible as well. And so these ground covers cover the space, which conserves water, and you don't need to mulch every year. And it actually builds the soil and improves the soil structure. So everything around, everything in your garden becomes more and more productive and happier.
Is it also... Is forest gardening something that works? What if you have a lot of mature trees in your yard and a lot of shade? Is that a problem for forest gardening, or is that something that's easier to deal with than a traditional garden? Dave, Jackie, did you want to?
You know, like I said earlier, you can do all different kinds of forest gardens, and that many of the things that people like to eat actually need pretty much full sun or close to it. So if you have a lot of mature trees, it'll limit your options for what crops you can grow. But like I said, French sorrel, good King Henry, chicory, a lot of the in fact, some of the greens actually make bigger leaves in the shade than they do in the sun.
Oh, okay.
So, which makes sense because the plant has to make more leaf area in order to get as much energy, so they actually make a bigger leaf. Greens are easier to grow in the shade. If you want to grow a root crop in the shade, you're not going to get as big a root crop because it's not as much energy for the plant to store. So you have to think about and strategize what you're going to grow. A lot of great medicinals grow in the shade. Currants and gooseberries. A guy in Britain, Martin Crawford, did a study with shade cloth. He found no drop in production of red currants in up to 40% shade. So even in if you have deeper than 40% shade in your yard, if you grow currants, you're still likely to get a decent crop. It may not be as big a crop as if you had full sun. And I've heard people tell me that the same with raspberries. You can get pretty good crops in partial shade with raspberries. But if it's deep, deep shade, mostly you're going to be growing maybe some spring ephemerals, which are plants that come up in the spring and they're green for a little while and they die back before summer. The best example of that would be ramps or wild leek. Allium tricoccum is the species. It's incredibly tasty. If you like onions, it's a very, very sweet onion. It's got two donkey ear-shaped leaves. Comes up in April for about a month. It's green for about a month, and then it dies back. So you get really good, tasty greens in early spring, and then it dies back, and it's gone. And it's basically, by doing that, it's growing. It's green when the trees haven't leafed out yet. So it's got essentially something close to full sun in that time of year, and then it goes away. So things like spring ephemerals, things like medicinal plants are great in a more full shade situation. You can also, if you have a lot of trees, you can say, okay, here's a tree that's getting pretty old. Maybe I'll take that tree out. You make a gap in the canopy, and then you can plant a nut tree or a fruit tree in that gap and let it take over in the space to convert the forest into something more that's going to be more productive. Persimmons would be good for that. Some of the nut trees get to be pretty huge. Mm-hmm. So those are all things you can do. Or pawpaws are another plant you can grow. I don't know if people know pawpaws around here. It's a
I thought that was grown in the tropical areas.
But... Well, pawpaw is the northernmost relative of a whole family of tropical plants, but it has this big. Kind of a weird shaped oblong fruit that is has a custardy texture, tastes like pawpaw. People say it tastes like avocado and pear mixed, but that's not really the best description. But they're very delicious, and the tree will grow. It's an understory tree. It will grow in shade, but it produces more in full sun.
We need to take a break for about 5 minutes. Talk of Iowa will continue after a break. We'll get back to our conversation with author Dave Jackie and Fred Meyer, director of Backyard Abundance, a nonprofit organization in Iowa that promotes forest gardens. Talk of Iowa continues in just a few minutes. Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese. We're talking this hour about forest gardens with Dave Jackie, author of Edible Forest Gardens, a two-volume book that promotes this concept, and it's a very interesting concept of turning your grass backyard into something much more interesting and useful. Dave Jackie and Fred Meyer say it's a lot of fun as well. Fred Meyer, director of Backyard Abundance, a nonprofit organization in Johnson County, now expanding into Jefferson County, promoting forest gardens. Fred, people might look at this title Forest Gardens and think it's a forest, but it's really more than that, right?
Absolutely. And Dave may have mentioned this before, but really the forest gardening concept is a metaphor for what we're trying to do. We're trying to model our landscapes off of healthy ecosystems. And really the closest analogy we can use here in urban setting is edible landscaping. And so we're just trying to create edible landscapes that are beautiful and resilient and model healthy ecosystems so they really take care of themselves. But we don't all have to get rid of all of our turf grass back lawns and you know, plant them all up in forests. A lot of people have kids and they want to have turf grass backyards where the kids can play. And, you know, that's perfectly fine. But there are a lot of other folks. But for the rest of those areas where it doesn't require play and recreation or pathways, perhaps we could plant them up with some beautiful edible landscaping.
So you don't have to go whole hog is what you're saying on this concept, right?
No, definitely not. It really depends on what people's goals are, whether they want to start overhaul their entire backyard all at once, or they can just do small patches.
And what if you have a really small yard? There just isn't much to it. Is there something you can still do to it to make it into something of a forest garden? Dave Jackie.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's often if you have a small yard, you still have a fair amount of vertical space, so you can grow vines. Now, you know, you mentioned grapes earlier, but even if you feel grapes don't grow well or you don't have the right environment to grow grapes, you could grow something like a hardy kiwi, which is a plant from China. It's got male and female flowers on two different plants. You got to grow at least one male for up to eight females. But you can get 100 pounds of fruit, just like the fuzzy kiwi you buy in the store, but smaller and fuzzless, so you don't have to peel it. And it actually tastes better than the one you buy in the store, and it'll grow hardy up to zone 2. And it's 10 times the vitamin C of lemon, and they taste great. And you can grow them up on a high trellis. They grow 20 to 100 feet high, depending on how much room you want to give it. They're pretty vigorous, but they're an incredible crop. A lot of food in a small area, and they can shade a hot spot if you want to make a patio cooler in the summertime and get food at the same time, and so on. So you can do stuff on rooftops. I know there's a website, www.risc.org.uk, and that's an organization in England that built a forest garden with trees and shrubs and everything on their rooftop of their organization. They give you details on how to build the roof so they can withstand the weight and deal with the water and everything. And so you can do this on the rooftop. And the great thing about building a forest garden on a rooftop is you don't have any deer up there.
Yeah. Well, the whole concept, you say, is more friendly to, speaking of deer and so forth, is more friendly to our various animals in our environment.
Yeah, and you know, we're creating habitat for all kinds of beneficial insects that help control diseases and pests. We're creating habitat for birds. You know, I have a whole table in the back of my book, volume 2 of my book, that lists all the beneficial animals that I could find information on and what their habitat requirements are and what you can do to attract them into your backyards. And I've never found a table like that anywhere. I had to work very hard to put that table together. So we can use that to design a habitat for the specific beneficial animals we want to have. And of course, yeah, I mean, oftentimes you need fencing to keep out the stuff you don't want. I mean, I don't really like skunks rooting around in my garden, so I don't want to get surprised some night while I'm out to harvest my hardy kiwis, you know.
So. Yeah. Dave Jackie, I'm dying to see what one of these forest gardens looks like. Are there websites to go to so you can? I'm sure your book probably has photographs, but are there is an easy way to see what these look like? Let's say on the web or something.
Yeah, I have on my website www.edibleforestgardens.com. I have a few photographs on there. If you Google forest gardens, I'm sure you'll find pictures. There's a few links on my website for that kind of thing. Another website would be Martin Crawford Agroforestry Research. Let me see. Anyway, Martin Crawford in Britain has photographs, and he actually sells a lot of plants, but it's hard to ship them over here. Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, CRMPI, they have a forest garden. He has images of his forest garden up on his website. And there's a new organization that I helped found, but I'm no longer associated with, but it's called the APIOS Institute, APIOS. And they have a wiki website where people can go and put up information about their own forest gardens and learn about forest gardens, and they'll, I'm sure, have pictures up as that wiki grows, people can contribute to that website of their with their own information, and that's part of the idea there. So apiosinstitute.org.
Fred Meyer, how much of a learning curve is there with all of this? I mean, you finished a 3-day workshop. I mean, how much time does it take somebody who has no idea how to start a forest garden to learn just some of the basics?
Well, that's interesting you asked that, Dennis. We're launching a series of programs called Create Abundant Landscapes to help people learn how to create these beautiful, resilient, food-bearing spaces that Dave and I have been talking about. And really, my belief is we simply create a space where people have the opportunity to bring that knowledge out of themselves. I really feel that this is something that is in all of us. We just need to reconnect to it and learn how to use skills that we have that have atrophied to some extent. And so what I have observed when I've talked with people about this and introduced this concept to folks is it's more of an aha moment. It's more of a profound moment that people get, and they know intuitively how to start gluing these various pieces of these various things together in their own backyards. It's just something that we need to bring out of them.
Of all these plants and these fruits and vegetables, good King Henry and a bunch of other plants I've never heard of, what is the most unusual plant that you've been trying to grow that you've come to know and love?
Actually, Good King Henry is a fabulous plant.
What is it again?
It's just it's a small green that comes up early in the spring, and it's just there all season long.
Okay.
And you can harvest it. It's great in soups, and I saute it, and I put it on sandwiches. And you usually have to cook it. It's really bitter if you don't cook it, but it's just always there. And that's the neat thing about this concept is your food is always available, which I think is a new concept to Americans, that they can just walk outside their door and go out into the landscape and eat.
Do you suppose there's some resistance for people who may not want to try some new fruits and vegetables? I mean, you mentioned we've been talking about good King Henry, sort of a green plant, something like lettuce. But are there cookbooks to teach people how to use some of these plants?
As of yet, there are not that many cookbooks. But the Apios Institute website is going to have some recipes showing up, I'm sure, especially if people start asking for it. But there's a book called Growing Unusual Vegetables that has a bunch of recipes in it. There's a lot of wild edible cookbooks, you know, for the native wild edibles. You can find good recipes for those. There's a plant called Native Harvests by E. Barry Kavash that has a lot of great recipes for native wild edibles. Highly recommended cookbook, that one. And, you know, there's a range of books out there, but not all of them are easy to find as of yet.
Well, I want to thank you two gentlemen very, very much. This has been fascinating, learning about forest gardening. Dave Jackie, Dynamics Ecological Design, Greenfield, Massachusetts. Dave, I wish you well with your travels to promote this very interesting concept. It seems to be going well, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely going great, and I appreciate the chance to talk to you and all the folks out here, the listening audience.
And Fred Meyer, Director of Backyard Abundance, do you have a website then?
Yeah, Backyard Abundance can be found on www.backyardabundance.org, all one word.
And you're trying, I'm sure, to expand this across as much of the state as you can?
Yeah, absolutely. We're hoping to see Backyard Abundance grow far beyond just Johnson and Jefferson County.
Okay. Dave Jackie, Fred Meyer, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Dave Jackie is the author of Edible Forest Gardens. He was in Iowa City over the weekend to conduct forest gardening workshops with Fred Meyer, director of the nonprofit organization Backyard Abundance of Iowa City. In the 1990s, as civil war and brutal ethnic cleansing tore the former Yugoslavia apart, thousands of Bosnians were driven from their homeland. Many were granted political asylum in America and found their way to resettlement centers in several cities, including Waterloo, Iowa. 15 years later, about 4,000 Bosnians continue to make the Cedar Valley their home. To commemorate the anniversary, the Bosnian Cultural Foundation is sponsoring Fields of Opportunity later this month, a symposium and celebration. I talked to Zulfida Rišća, who emigrated to Waterloo from Bosnia in 1996 and is now director of the Folk Music Ensemble, and Ryan Haynes, project director of the Bosnian Cultural Foundation of Waterloo. Ryan, I want to talk to you about Fields of Opportunity, commemorating the 15th anniversary of Bosnian resettlement in the Cedar Valley. You've got events coming up late in March. So it really has been, it seems like it's been longer than that, but the Bosnian people who moved to the Waterloo area have been there just exactly 15 years, is that right?
Yes, they'll be coming into their 15th year of being in Waterloo. Obviously, some have come as late as 2001, but between the period of 1995 into 2001 is when Bosnians started coming into the area.
Well, can you give us some history of this? I mean, why did they come to the United States, and why did they choose Northeast Iowa?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. Generally, after the Dayton Accords, the U.S. was opened up as one of about 12 countries in which Bosnians were resettled. And Waterloo specifically was not designated as a city in which Bosnians were going to be resettled. There were other communities out east. Utica, New York is one, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and then larger cities like Chicago and New York, San Francisco. But Bosnians were lured to Waterloo because of industry and the need for a labor force, both through then IBP and John Deere. And so they were brought in from other cities like Chicago. And then, you know, at that time, it was up to social services like Lutheran Services in Iowa and Black Hawk County Relief to help resettle the Bosnians.
Was the community of Waterloo happy to get these folks from Bosnia to be permanent residents? Was this a good thing for the community?
I think it was a fantastic thing for the community, and it seemed to come at just the right time. It was kind of, you know, for the community just to be recovering from the farm crisis of the 1980s and just kind of on an upswing. And then there was this dramatic influx in people and a ready and willing labor force. So it was just a very good marriage there.
Where are most of the Bosnians working? You mentioned John Deere, but where else?
Well, still there's still a significant population that work at Tyson. And then there's a few trucking industries up in Waterloo that employ a significant number of birch cabinets. You know, there are a lot who have since gone back and gotten degrees and are now professionals in various industries, various fields like education and real estate, banking.
And when they arrived here, were they speaking English, or was that something they had to learn?
That was something that most everybody had to learn, yeah. Some took intensive English classes when they arrived in the various cities in which they were resettled, and some have since learned English as they've been here and just kind of picking it up through television or, you know, other English classes. Hawkeye's been great. Hawkeye Community College, that is, has been great. Been a great resource for that.
And how has a completely different ethnic community contributed to the cultural environment in Waterloo and Cedar Falls?
Yeah, it's fantastic. There are Bosnian restaurants in Waterloo. There are Bosnian grocery stores, Bosnian bakeries, Bosnian butcher shops. Very interestingly, a lot of big acts will also come through the Cedar Valley. Just last October, Hanka Paldum, who's sort of a diva of traditional Bosnian music, made a stop specifically to Waterloo to Cedar Falls to perform at the Gallagher Blue Dorn. And a lot of major Bosnian touring acts will come through. When they come through the U.S., their tour dates will include New York, Chicago, Detroit, and Waterloo, Iowa. You know, so it's...
So what's the music like? We're talking about traditional sort of folk music or what?
Well, being that it was a communist country, there was a strong promotion of traditional music. And so popular artists kind of incorporated traditional styles into their music as well. So in a lot of popular music, you still get traditional instruments, traditional melodies, and almost even the idea, well, certainly the idea that that songs can be covered and that people should know the songs and sing along. So, you know, it's an interesting mix. It's really participatory. And especially when you go to one of the events, there's a lot of dancing, and not just as a presentation, but it's encouraged that everybody gets up and dances.
Okay. I have to ask, what is Bosnian food like?
Bosnian food is sort of a mix of Turkish and Mediterranean. And then because a majority of the Bosnians in Waterloo are Muslim, you get specialties in beef and lamb. And lots of grilled meats and good breads. And then the mix of vegetables is primarily Mediterranean.
Hmm. Fields of opportunity, Ryan. What events are scheduled late in March then?
We have a symposium gathering experts and scholars from around the country, really, to speak on resettlement in the Cedar Valley specifically, and then also resettlement in the U.S. more broadly. And that'll be at the Waterloo Center for the Arts at 1:30 in the afternoon on March 26th. And then in the evening, we're going to have sort of a celebration and concert, bringing in groups from both Waterloo and then also from Des Moines, and then the University of Illinois Balkan Folk Music Orchestra is also going to come and perform. And there's going to be a great collaboration between the Waterloo Dance Ensemble Kutkolo and Balkanalia, the orchestra. They're going to dance and play simultaneously, which would be like one of the first times that that's happened here in the U.S. So that should be very exciting. And then Saturday morning, there's going to be another concert with Balkanalia and Kutkolo at the Hirsch Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls, sort of inviting kids and families to come check out Bosnian dancing and Balkan music more generally. And then a kind of ongoing project is this oral history project in which we're compiling oral history interviews, both of people who have come from Bosnia and also people who helped to resettle them. And so that we have a small exhibition going on in, through the month of April at the Waterloo Center for the Arts, and then that'll kind of, we hope to keep it going and create an archive, an online archive, as well as a physical archive in the future.
Have the Bosnians melded in well with the community? Does the community accept them? Or how has it gone over the past 15 years generally?
Generally speaking, I think it's gone really great. Most people that I speak to have been, you know, they thought it was just a wonderful opportunity. I think the whole Cedar Valley community really reached out and helped in a lot of ways. When Bosnians first came in and were really needing a lot of material items, there was huge donation drives through area churches, and so I think all in all, yeah, it's been a great experience for everybody.
Ryan, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dennis.
Zolfida, you're director of the Folk Music Ensemble, the Bosnian Cultural Foundation, celebrating 15 years of the Bosnian settlement in Waterloo. Have you been here for all 15 years?
Yeah, actually 14.
14?
I came here in 1996.
And how have you liked it in Iowa?
So far, it's so good. I like it. And we came and looking for a job, and we find the job, and then we stayed, and it's great. It's great life. We love it.
And what are you doing then?
Right now, I'm pursuing my teaching degree. And I'm doing my student teaching to get my degree in elementary education with ELL endorsement, because I used to be a teacher in Bosnia, so I just went back to school at UNI, and then I'm almost done.
Well, your English is excellent. Were you speaking good English when you got here about 14 years ago?
Thank you, but I didn't speak any English before.
Okay. Tell us about Fields of Opportunity coming up later. This is an interesting event with lots of things going on, including great music, it sounds like.
It'll be like, it's not just Bosnian, because we are, our ensemble, KOLO, K-O-L-O, that's a spelling, and it's an ensemble who perform dances and songs from Bosnia, but because Bosnia is a multi-ethnic country, because we have three ethnic groups. And then we also perform international. We have our international repertoire, so we're performing dances from Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, Macedonia, and other Balkan countries from Balkan region. So we are open, pretty open, not just for Bosnian music and dances. It's mostly for everyone.
Is there a lot of interest in the part of Iowans in your culture? I mean, Are people curious to learn more about it, and especially music?
Yeah, right now it was like at the beginning when we just came here, and people actually they didn't have a clue where Bosnia is. So we just through our dances and our songs, because each dance is in the song is about one story, and is describing one tradition from our culture. And each dance is like coming from different region from Bosnia. So through those, through dances and music, we are telling them the story about our country. So they're learning more and more about us. So at the beginning, it wasn't so, I mean, it was more like, oh, we don't know, can you teach us? Now it's more and more interest, and they're like amazed, and they love it. Most, like lots of people, they like, Bosnian music doesn't sound so strange like it used to be before Bosnia.
Okay, for people who are interested in learning more about the activities later this month, is there a website that people can go to find some of these things detailed?
Yeah, we have a website right now. It's finally, I'm so excited about that. It's www.bosnianculturalfoundation.org. And there is some information about upcoming events. And then so far we are having, in March, we have that event, but we're having some more events. We'll have more events like in June and next year. So now we have websites so more people can learn about those events.
Zolfada, thank you. I appreciate the conversation. Wish you well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Zolfada Rijca is director of the Bosnian Folk Music Ensemble in Waterloo. Ryan Haynes is project director of the Bosnian Cultural Foundation in Waterloo. For more information on the Fields of Opportunity celebration set for March 26th and 27th, go to www.bosnianculturalfoundation.org. That's Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.